At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. This week, I'm joined by eating disorder therapist Manal Muller. It was really lovely to speak to Manal this week about eating disorders through the lens of faith and spirituality, and how elements like faith, spirituality, and religion can both impact the development of an eating disorder, but also be the change that allows somebody to recover from their eating disorder and to promote health and well-being within their life. It was really, really interesting to explore this, and I'm really grateful for now being so open to the conversation and allowing us to dig deep into how these things can impact somebody's own journey.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. I can't remember, are you based in the UK? Are you out of the UK?
I'm not based in the UK anymore. I used to be based in the UK, but I'm back in Dubai where I grew up and stuff.
Oh, yeah. Nice. So what's the time for you?
It's almost 9:15, like 9:12 right now. Yeah.
Oh, wow. I'm sorry. You should be resting.
No, it's okay. I'm used to kind of the one-off kind of going a bit later in the evening because I still work in the UK part time.
Got you. Yeah, I'm actually coming to Dubai on Saturday because I'm flying to Indonesia. Unfortunately, we're not stopping, but that's where my layover is. I didn't book the flights, but I said to my partner, I was like, why are we not spending time there? We're going all that way and we're literally flying into the airport and then out again. So that is a massive shame.
Indonesia is amazing. I've been, so it's lovely. Food's amazing. It's all good.
Yeah. Oh, amazing. You'll have to, I won't obviously take up the podcast asking for recommendations because it's not a travel podcast, but you have to tell me what you got up to. Because I have massive FOMO when I go to places I don't like to miss and out on anything.
Of course. Yeah. Happy to.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Thank you so much for joining me. It's really nice that we've got that mutual connection of first steps. So that's lovely that we have that. But we're going to talk a bit about faith and spirituality today and the link to eating disorders. So I wondered if, I guess to start with, do you want to talk about your approach to working with clients? And I think when we kind of set it out initially, we're going to talk about the five pillars of health and how you incorporate that. So I don't know whether you want to weave that into kind of the introduction as well.
Yeah, of course. So my approach to eating disorders, I think first of all, it starts with my core training, which is integrative. And that just means that I take a few different types of therapy and integrate them to support the client. So that would be cognitive behavioral therapy, which is, fairly common in the UK. It's about how our thoughts, feelings, and behaviors are linked together. The other one's attachment theory, and that's about how our childhood impacts our life in a lot of ways. And the last one is the person-centered approach, which I think the kind of simplest way to define that is to say that really the client is in the driver's seat for the process, the therapeutic process. And I think that's really the most important part of supporting a client with an eating disorder, You know, we often see a link with control, where, you know, actually giving, you know, the person that's sitting in front of you that sense of control of, you know, we don't have to go in a direction that doesn't feel safe for you or that doesn't feel, that you don't feel ready for. I think that can be really helpful for someone, especially, you know, just kind of new to treatment. As for, I guess, five pillars of health, just to name them, so we have sleep, nutrition, movement, connection, so positive social connection, and stress management. I think depending on people's beliefs, faith and spirituality could really be a part of all of those five pillars of health. I think, you know, I like to think of those pillars of health as like a bit of a domino effect, where it's like, you know, if you get the sound sleep, you wake up feeling less anxious, less stressed. You know, if you get that movement in, you know, if you are feeling some level of stress or anxiety, that it kind of allows you to let go of that a little bit as well, clears your mind, gives you those endorphins. So, you know, when we're thinking of those pillars, it's, you know, it's not that we have to work on all five of them together. It's we start with one and, you know, the others start to fall into place as well.
Yeah. Something that really stood out to me when you were talking then was the approach that you have to treatment and the fact that you kind of hand that sort of control or kind of the direction of the treatment over to the patient and kind of say, you know, it's what you're ready for right now. And I think that is something that is so unbelievably important in treatment, but is often sort of, I think in some respects, when you're not in private treatment, it's very prescriptive in the sense of, you know, you've got an eating disorder, then well, this is what we do first, this is what we do second. And, you know, if that doesn't fit for you, then that's your issue rather than an issue with the treatment process. So it's amazing that you're able to kind of have that adaptable approach and recognize that as well.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think it is so hard really to, you know, come into something and I think sometimes just be told that this is, you know, this is all we have room for, right? We can't go anywhere else. But I also, you know, appreciate that some clients do respond really well to structure. I think it's just the level of rigidity there, where it's like, yes, that's structure, but we can also move in ways that you want to move in.
Yeah. And in a sense, and as I'm saying this, I'm kind of thinking, is that a good thing or a bad thing? But I think it's a good thing. Kind of handing over that control to somebody. Because, you know, in my experience, my eating disorder has very much been about controlling the controllable and then that, like, supports the uncontrollable. And I know that's not the case for everybody, like, but there is, you know, a common theme that people do experience it because of control. And I'm almost thinking because you kind of hand the like steering wheel over to the patient in terms of the direction, it's almost that sensation of control and in a sense that relieves the need for control in the eating disorder. And when I was thinking that in my head, I was like, is that a good thing though? But in actual fact, I think it is, because I've always thought with eating disorder behaviors, it's not necessarily that the thing that drives them is a negative, you know, perfectionism or whatever. They can actually be quite useful, but it's being able to balance them and use them appropriately.
I think there's definitely layers to that. You know, especially when, you know, especially when you said perfectionism, actually, I'm thinking, you know, I think for me, you know, a cultural standpoint and, you know, even within society, there's certainly certain behaviors that are more rewarded when I think the internal struggle is what's hidden sometimes. I think for me, one of the biggest things for me to learn whilst I was on training, and you know, as someone who certainly struggles with perfectionistic traits myself, what I learned, at least through supervision, was that sometimes perfectionism is really our kind of armor from low self-esteem, you know, where it's like, you know, it's that you know, it's never going to be good enough, so I need to try and try and try. Or it can really go the other way around, which is it's never going to be good enough, why should I even start? And that shows up as procrastination. So it can really go in either direction, but it's that armor to protect us from, you know, the shame of this isn't going to be good enough, or I don't think I'm good enough. And that was a hard pill for me to swallow as well. So I, you know, I sit there sometimes in sessions and I'm like, I hope my client is ready to hear that, because it's tough.
Yeah. I think it's a very interesting point. And for me, working through kind of being enough and things like that is something that's really prominent in my therapy right now. And you're so right in that when you don't necessarily feel enough, or that, you know, what you're going to be doing is enough, you do go either way of either, okay, right now then, okay, so I don't think I'm going to be enough, therefore I have to control everything. And like, I can't stop. Like, I'm so hyper aware of this intense emotion to just control everything. Or I just kind of detract from everything. And I like resort into myself and just kind of, you know, everything's fine because I'm just hidden in this little corner. And all I have to think about now is the eating disorder behaviors or whatever.
And so
you either like fully immerse yourself or you completely disengage. And again, it's that perfectionism of that all or nothing, I think.
Yeah. 100%. The all or nothing thinking is so prevalent, right? It keeps coming up. I think, you know, especially with eating disorders as well, we see a lot of overlap with neurodivergence. And that's where really the all or nothing thinking is. We see that a lot more, actually, especially when it overlaps with neurodivergence. But yeah, it's that's, you know, if there were kind of, you know, the first five things that I would want to say to someone, like as part of psychoeducation, you know, helping them learn about what's going on, all or nothing would be one of them for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess with that in mind, we spoke about sort of the five pillars of health before. With thinking about that sort of perfectionistic tendency and that all or nothing, for me, it feels like an area that you could potentially be like, okay, so now I have these things that I need to, you know, in order to get better, I now have to be perfect at these things. So how do you navigate that with clients to ensure that, you know, what they're doing is actually supporting them rather than as like, you know, more pressure to have the perfect sleep routine and have the perfect exercise routine and all of that?
Yeah. I think the most important thing is starting small. What we see with really any kind of perfectionism is that strong critical voice, which is, you know, always kind of bullying you into doing what needs to be done, or, you know, pushing in a certain direction. I think starting small in a way that can is actually that where it's possible to actually have that behavior be consistent. But also, you know, it's not just in the pillars of health that perfectionism can literally show up in therapy, where it's like, I need to be the perfect client. And I see that so much, right? Where it's like, it's this idea that at the end of the session or at the end of the, you know, how many of the sessions, there's going to be this big ceremony where it's like, oh, you've been so great. And, you know, this is your kind of certificate, you know, go on. and sometimes it's about really telling the person that's sitting in front of you that it's, you know, it's okay to not be perfect, that version of us really cannot exist. And when we show up in therapy, we have to show up with our imperfection. You know, if everything's great, then we wouldn't need the support. But also, no one's perfect. You know, I think we all need some version of support at some point in our lives. But I think something that I like to do sometimes is a little bit of self-disclosure of like showing my clients how I'm not perfect either. You know, this idea that you know, someone who works in kind of health and social care might have their health and well-being just sorted. And really, that's not the case. Allowing them to see, or really modeling for people that, that I too struggle with perfectionistic traits sometimes, that I, I'm still figuring it out, and that's just human. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And I really liked that you mentioned about, like, you know, being the perfect patient or client and, you know, having everything figured out, because it's like, well, there's a reason you sat in that chair, and that's because everything's not figured out and you need help with that. But I think it can often be difficult to kind of show those vulnerabilities. So I think by having the person opposite you show their vulnerabilities, it can be really, really important. But I wanted to come on to sort of like the spirituality and the faith.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
Conversation with you. And I wanted to discuss sort of, you know, both how that could be positive and negative in terms of the development of an eating disorder and then recovery as well. So I guess if we start with sort of the negative, because then we can go on to the nice bit. Do you think there's like particular factors that could lead to somebody developing an eating disorder within their spirituality, their faith, that sort of thing?
I haven't seen the development of an eating disorder in terms of faith and spirituality, but I have seen how it might aid it. In a lot of, I think, belief systems, you know, there will be a version of, giving up some things. So that could be in the form of food, that could be in the form of kind of worldly desires. You know, there's really many versions of that. But when I think about, especially, you know, the practices where you give up food, be it for a certain amount of time or certain types of foods, I think that can really quickly fall into if there's existing eating disorder behaviors, that can then be, you know, that can then just make it even more possible to do without anyone actually thinking that something's off there. I'm Muslim, like I've seen this within the Muslim community as well, where for a lot of people, they'll use Ramadan, where you fast from dawn to dusk, but you do need to eat the pre-dawn meal and you do need to eat post sunset and everything. But I think for a lot of people, especially where there's existing disordered eating or some of those behaviors, that it just becomes, you know, another opportunity to then not eat, or to then I guess restrict even more than they would usually. Or it could go from just, you know, I guess restricting certain foods to not eating at all, and then that becomes their kind of 1 month. So I think certainly it can aid those behaviors sometimes. But I think what's hard there to figure out is that, you know, we may not really have that much really mental health literacy to see what an eating disorder behavior is. One person can, you know, fast the dawn to dusk and have it be really, you know, intentional about faith and spirituality, and for another person, really it might be their disordered behavior. So I think it's important to look for the other signs as well. I think as a community, as a culture, develop that mental health literacy to see what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're so right in that it's a very difficult one to kind of draw the line between. Because, you know, we've done podcasts before where we've discussed Ramadan, and for some individuals, it's, you know, it is part of their religious practice and, you know, it's a completely healthy thing for them to be doing. But it's then equally a very difficult time for some individuals that struggle with disordered eating, because the behaviours that are causing so much distress to them day in, day out are then being glorified and are being, you know, recommended, or, you know, that's kind of what they're told to do. And then if you can't engage with that, it's almost, you know, the shame and the, if religion and faith is something that's so important to you, to then not be able to engage, I can imagine can be quite lonely and isolating, which then kind of increases those feelings around the eating disorder. But I've definitely heard a lot in that, you know, it's a very difficult one to navigate because you can't really, you know, it's very difficult to pick apart, you know, am I doing this because I want to, you know, follow my religious and cultural practices, or am I doing this because of the eating disorder? And even then, when there's maybe not that much awareness about it, I've heard people say, you know, I realized that I could go for prolonged periods of time and not eat. And so then I was fasting after Ramadan as well. And it sort of developed those thoughts in my head of, you know, why am I not doing this more often? But it's hard when it's something that is so important to you as well.
Absolutely. I think you make such an excellent point about, you know, the feelings of isolation or the shame that can come with it. I think especially, you know, when you think of more collectivist cultures where it's really about, you know, following the group and I guess being loyal to that group, it can feel really shameful to not do what the rest of the group is doing. Even though, you know, from a religious perspective, if you're not well, you don't need to fast. Mm-hmm. And I think we miss out on that sometimes because, you know, our understanding of being well is very much tied to the physical, not necessarily the mental, or really both. I think it is quite difficult, even, you know, even for people that might be struggling with, you know, binge eating, or really, you know, even others, because, you know, even though Ramadan is about fasting, you are often surrounded by food when it is time to eat. And a lot of food sometimes, you know, depending on, you know, what your, you know, culture is like, especially around your family and things. And that can be quite anxiety provoking for someone that's, you know, in recovery or struggling. It really is a lot to be surrounded by that much food for 30 days, where, you know, it can be part of social gatherings as well then.
And I think that's the difficult thing, isn't it, in that kind of restrict binge cycle that people might struggle with is kind of normal during that time. And I think that's often something that is difficult, is when the behaviors that you're struggling with are kind of normalized and just kind of accepted as what it is, because then you feel like, well, why am I struggling with this when everybody else seems to be able to cope with it? I guess just on that topic, not specific to Ramadan, but, you know, if somebody is finding that they're kind of, you know, maybe it's their religion or culture or whatever, is almost promoting the behaviours or the feelings that they're having, what would your advice be to sort of navigate having that conversation with someone? Because I think it would be really, really hard when it's something that is, like I've said before, so important and followed by so many.
I think, you know, first and foremost, especially when it comes to faith and spirituality, I think the intention is really important. You know, what is pushing you to be part of this practice? You know, the intention setting is actually a very important part of a lot of faith traditions. So I would think intention, but also educating yourself on, you know, what is the reason behind these practices, right? Are we, you know, I think, you know, for a lot of us, we think, you know, practices like Ramadan and, you know, other fasting, you know, in other beliefs as well, is really just about the food, but, you know, it's actually not. There's so much more that you actually have to think about. It's about, you know, purifying your beliefs, your character, you know, it's about, you know, being a better person throughout the month. And I think it's also about thinking of, okay, if you're not able to be part of some of the food side of the practices, you know, how can we focus on the others, right? You know, what is it that we can control? You know, we do this really interesting exercise called the circles of control, where we draw the person in the middle and we think, okay, what is in your control and what is out of your control? And, you know, let's just write down anything and everything that you can think of and, you know, stick it up, okay? The moment you start to feel out of control with some of those things that you've already written down in that circle, come back to that inner circle, which is in your control. Because it can get really overwhelming, you know, thinking of everything that something like fasting entails, or, you know, those cultural practices where it's not just you having to follow it, but you might have to follow it as a group, or there might be gatherings related to that, or, you know, it might be, you know, for a whole month. I think definitely think of intentions, you know, educate yourself on why that's a practice, what's the goal for that, and try to engage in what you can control rather than what you can't.
Yeah. I love that idea of the control circles. I think I might try that myself. In order to really, you know, understand, you know, what is it right now that you can control and what, you know, is completely out of your control. Because at the end of the day, you know, it's very easy to say, but there is no point wasting your energy on things that you can't control. And that's really difficult. But I think that comes into everyday life and not just eating disorders. So definitely a useful kind of piece of advice there. And I think, you know, there's a reason why so many people do follow specific religions or cultures of faiths. So in your sort of, from your perspective, what positives do you find, you know, what positives have you seen with patients in terms of their spirituality and faith and what that's had on their recovery?
Yeah. I think, you know, there's really variations of that depending on how much one relies on faith and spirituality for their recovery. I think I've seen that, especially when we think of body image difficulties or, you know, and there's the spectrum of that. I can go up to body dysmorphia as well. But from a, you know, from the lens of spirituality, sometimes viewing it as, you know, just there's a sense of gratitude for the way that we are made, that we are unique, that we have, you know, certainly, you know, when you struggle with an eating disorder, your body might not function in the way that you would like it to, but it's about identifying the things that it can still do for you. And that it has done for you all of those years. I think that sense of gratitude can be really healing for a lot of people. I think it can also accelerate recovery sometimes, where, you know, it's about, I guess, treating your body in a way where you want to continue to feel that sense of gratitude. Taking care of yourself. It can also show up when we think of comparison with body image issues. So, you know, we were made in a certain way for a reason, and that, you know, if we all looked exactly the same, or if we all were exactly the same, we wouldn't have this, I guess, this the beauty that is in diversity in our world. And I think that's really beautiful to think of in a very deep way, the way that we're fashioned. I think for a lot of people, especially with, you know, the number of thoughts that we can have about food or body image or, you know, things we want to control, you know, there was a recent study that came out that said we have about 6,000 thoughts a day, which is a lot, yeah. And I think someone that might be struggling with food and body image, you know, the percentage of those thoughts that are about food and the way that they look. So a lot of, you know, faith traditions have a meditative practice of sorts. Mm-hmm. I think we might call it meditation, but it looks a little bit different in every practice. But it serves the same purpose, which is, you know, having to focus on something, be it, you know, chanting something, be it, you know, reading something that is, you know, that are verses of a holy book. But it's about focusing on something enough to, you know, as you have those thoughts come up, that you still are able to unhook from them and back. And mm-hmm. focus back on what you're like reading or chanting, and really that's meditation as we understand it. It's about allowing those thoughts to flow. It's not that we don't have any thoughts come up, but it's just that we're able to bring our focus back. So that can really help with reducing the just how many thoughts we have, because it allows us to develop our kind of focus. But also it can be helpful to know that, you know, we don't have to believe every passing thought that we have. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's such an important thing to say, is I've tried meditating so many times myself. I can't do it. My thoughts keep spiralizing and it's too distracting. And then my friend who is a health well-being coach, like, that's the whole point. You're supposed to have lots of thoughts. We all have lots of thoughts. It's about bringing yourself back. And I think for me, the thing that stands out in terms of how spirituality and faith could support recovery is, a lot of the time in recovery from an eating disorder, someone's kind of whole self is encompassed by their eating disorder. And mm-hmm. so when they're in recovery, that it feels like a massive loss in terms of, like, who am I? Like, what do I believe in? Like, you know, what am I going to do with my spare time? Because it was filled with all these thoughts or behaviors before. And I think for me, it's almost something to almost have a purpose, to have something mm-hmm. to kind of have faith in and believe in and, like, dedicate yourself to in... Yeah. I don't know whether I'm getting it across in the right way that I mean to be, but to really sort of transition from, I'm not saying that eating disorders are like a faith or a whatever, but they do kind of take over you. So yeah, to have something almost as a replacement in a way of, you know, I'm really not getting this across very well.
I think I get what you're saying. So I think eating, maybe what you're trying to say is that eating disorders can be so consuming mm-hmm. that, you know, having a purpose of sorts, be it, you know, in any form linked mm-hmm. to faith and spirituality, can give us a direction in a way to look outside of ourselves rather than just... Yeah,
absolutely. And I think you've knocked the nail on the head. It's looking outside of yourself rather than, you know, just internally. And I think having something that means so much to you, and in a sense, almost like a distraction or like a refocus, I guess, on, like, what's important to you and, you know, what you want from your life. And also with sort of like spirituality and faith, I think that there's a big community sense there as well, and where eating disorders can be so isolating and if there is a community, then it's often quite a toxic one. If when people are in any sort of not in recovery. If you have, you know, a religion or a faith, and then there's a group of you that celebrate that together, it I can imagine would give so much positive energy that, you know, you wouldn't feel like you need to lean into the eating disorder for that purpose or those sort of like emotional needs anymore.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think you know, it goes back a little bit to the kind of pillars of health, where social connection is really important. And having that be a practice, you know, in some faiths, you know, you might say, you know, go to your place of worship, you know, every day of, once every week, you know, that kind of practice, where even there's a, you know, that there's a consistency there's a predictability there of, okay, we're going to do this every say Friday or every Sunday, you know, that in itself, knowing that you have that community to rely on, even if it's just one day of the week, can be so helpful. With eating disorders, you know, we see a lot of anxiety. You know, if we want to try to regulate that through the people around us, it's about building some form of consistency and predictability. So, you know, I always say, yes, we can try really hard to regulate our emotions, to regulate our anxiety, but people regulate our emotions and our anxiety as well. So, you know, you might have the, you know, the friend that helps you feel really safe and you don't know why. It's probably because they're really consistent and predictable in their behavior. And you might feel really anxious around some people, and it's because they're really unpredictable and you don't know what's coming next. Yeah. Having that sense of routine, be it with your community, with prayer, you know, whatever that is, but that routine, that consistency is really, really good for us to keep our anxiety at bay, which is deeply linked with eating disorders as well.
Yeah, I think you've absolutely knocked the nail on the head there. It's having something that you can always rely on, yeah, and that gives you structure and purpose and helps you to feel safe. I think that's something that people often go to an eating disorder for, and it's those false promises that it can give you that, and it actually, yeah, doesn't. So to be able to have that, you know, through your recovery as something that is there for you all the time, when you know it's something that, yes, it could be a community, but also, like you said, whether it's prayer or meditation, it's something that you can lean into when you need it, and that can be at any moment. I think that feels so important and really nice that can have such a positive impact on people. I just wonder if you've had any patients that you've kind of seen spirituality and faith be such a core part of their recovery, if there was anything that you wanted to share.
I think something I've come across is, you know, we always think of just reminders, especially kind of visual cues, and I've seen this with, you know, a few times in my work where clients might put up certain verses or certain, prayers, like up on their wall, that remind them of, you know, what you were talking about earlier, that, you know, there's more to life than just them, just being stuck in their own thoughts. There's also been, some reminders about, paying more attention to character rather than the body that we exist in, just to remind them that, you know, yes, you can look at yourself in the mirror and, I think, you know, find all of these flaws, but, you know, when and really this is in a few faith beliefs that I've seen, but when the end is there and, you know, you've passed away, what will be remembered of you won't really be the body that you existed in anymore. You know, it would be, you know, how you made people feel, the character that you had, how much charity you gave, things of that sort. Mm-hmm. So I think really taking away from the physical being. You know, yes, we exist in this body, but it really is a vehicle for us to get around. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just picturing somebody's eulogy and probably quite sadistically being like, yeah, banging bod, it's probably not going to happen, is it? It would be a lot lovelier for someone to say, oh, you know, all the personality traits they had and the nice things that they did. Personally, that's what I would like, not just like, you know, she was skinny or whatever. And something that I'm kind of interested from your perspective is, so you mentioned that you're Muslim, so I'm sure that religion means a lot to you. When you're working with clients, is it something that kind of you feel you need to align with the client with? Or, you know, would it be difficult for you to work with somebody that maybe had a different religion or a different faith for you? Or like, not maybe difficult for them to work with you as well?
Yeah. Such an interesting question, honestly. I think first and foremost, it's just in terms of how we train therapists and things. Faith and spirituality is often the, you know, the forgotten piece of the puzzle, where, you know, even on training, we don't really like actually focus on it, where it's like, okay, you know, we'll do the lecture on working within diversity, and it's, you know, it's everything but faith and spirituality. You know, you'll get the race, the culture, the ethnicity, and, you know, everything else but, you know, faith and spirituality is the forgotten piece of that puzzle. So I think for me, it's actually taken some time to acknowledge that piece of the puzzle in the room. And I think only when I started to acknowledge it for myself was I then more comfortable to acknowledge it for the person that was sitting in front of me. So I do now, you know, in a first session ask, you know, what is your belief system? Right? And it doesn't have to, you know, you don't have to be someone that aligns with a particular faith or spiritual belief. But, you know, growing up, what were the beliefs around you, right? Where did your values come from? And it could be as simple as, oh, my values aren't tied to faith or any kind of spiritual belief, but they're just tied to what, you know, mom and dad taught me. Mm-hmm. And that's okay as well. But I think when we don't explore that, or when we don't make room for that, it is very hard to understand our clients, right? What is the lens that they make decisions with? What is the lens that they use to, you know, to even, I guess, differentiate between right and wrong? So in my work, honestly, I haven't worked with too many clients who identify with really any faith, a belief or faith tradition, I would say. That's been quite rare in my work. But I think that I wouldn't want to see that as black and white, where just because there is no alignment to a faith tradition, that then their beliefs don't matter. Mm-hmm. You know, in fact, sometimes exploring what those beliefs are, or you know, what they would like to actually subscribe to as well, can be really interesting for their recovery. Where you know, when we think of anxiety, right? What does your, you know, what does your client believe? Do they believe that life is predictable? Do they believe that someone else is in control? Do they believe a higher power is in control, or is it science? You know, I think those can be really interesting conversations that can, you know, help the client themselves understand, okay, what is it that I actually want to believe, and what is it that's actually going to help me make sense of it all? Because it can be quite overwhelming and confusing, you know, especially if they've never had to explore that before.
Yeah, I think that's such a good approach to it, in that it doesn't have to match you in terms of what you believe, or, you know, what your faith is, but just addressing it is really mm-hmm. important. And I think with regards to anything in terms of your beliefs, like not necessarily like, you know, do you believe in God or that sort of thing, but where any of your beliefs have come from, you know, like having a smaller body is better or whatever you may think, it's really important to track that back, to know where that comes from and to understand, you know, why that is so important to you as well. So I think, like you said, giving that the space that you need to be able to unpack that and sort of understand it feels really important. And I do often think it's a really interesting conversation about like whether your therapist, you know, has to align with your religion or has to align. Like I have a friend who's polyamorous and she's also bisexual, and for her obviously it's a different topic, but for her she didn't feel that she could have a therapist that wasn't also bisexual and polyamorous because she felt like that was such a big part of her that it needed to be understood. And so I think that's very similar in a sense to religion and things like that, in that because it is such a big part of you and makes up such a big part of your beliefs, you may feel like if you don't have somebody that aligns with that religion, they're going to be missing out a lot of things. So I do think it's an interesting one, but equally, like you said, it's not necessarily black and white. And I don't think that, you know, you could say just because you follow a certain religion, your therapist should too. But equally, I don't think that you can say, well, you don't need to have a therapist that follows the same religion as you, because I think it massively depends on the choice of the person.
Absolutely, absolutely. It is, you know, client autonomy is a very important ethical principle. I think it can be quite interesting, though, you know, the choices that we make. You know, the word we use there is cultural closeness. So some people might actively opt for a therapist that is perhaps of the same faith as them, you know, for that understanding. And some people might actively opt for a therapist that, you know, is not of the same faith of them, as them, or not of the same culture as them, or and I think there are so many layers to that as well. To be very honest with you, I have had so when I was on training, you know, you would receive an assessment and you would be asked, okay, you know, this is the client that you're allocated to. You know, I've had experiences where a client wouldn't want to see me, and again, that's completely okay, that's their choice, because of the cultural closeness. And I think it's very important then for the therapist that they do end up seeing to identify what that's really about. You know, it's we are a product of our, you know, our genetics and our experiences, and sometimes our experiences, you know, can really affect the lens that we see people with. So you know, you'll see this in day-to-day life, not just in therapy, but you know, as you go through life, there will be people who will remind you of certain people. And that can be like a positive memory, and that can be a not so positive one as well. And it's like, okay, but what's really going on for me? So therapy is a very interesting place to explore, you know, why we might steer towards or away from cultural closeness.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really interesting thing. And like you've just said there, I would question if it was that something felt too close culturally, like why is that something that you're worried to go near? What's that bringing up for you? And whether you decide to then go with that therapist to address that, or with the therapist that maybe feels more appropriate to you, then address that with them in terms of why didn't I feel like I could do that? I think that's a very interesting perspective. But it does make me think, maybe this is a whole different conversation, sort of, I guess, about like the racial element of that. And in terms of if, you know, if, I guess what I'm saying is, where do you draw the line? And maybe this is down to the individual person as well, but let's say somebody didn't want to work with somebody based on the stigmas or belief that they had around their race or their culture. if they're coming for eating disorder support, would you say that that's the time to unpack that, or is that a kind of completely separate thing?
I think, you know, as I said at the beginning, like, you know, the client is in the driver's seat for the process, at least, you know, for me. I also think that, you know, it's sometimes, you know, you have to really think of whether the client is ready to explore that. You know, we all have our biases. We all, I don't think anyone is completely free of prejudice. You know, we're human. But also, if you're, you know, if as the therapist, you're not really making for a safe environment for them to explore why they might have those beliefs and from where they, you know, where they come from, I think you're doing a disservice to the client. You know, a client is only going to open up when they feel safe. But if you're going to question them on their beliefs in a way that's, you know, it can be quite, you know, just kind of jarring for them. I don't think, you know, I don't think it's doing anyone any favors. But certainly therapy would be a great place to explore why one might have those beliefs. But it's about timing. You know, when does it actually feel right to go in that direction? For me personally, every 4 to 6 sessions, I have a review session where I actually do ask my client very openly, and this isn't common practice, but this is something I, you know, I learned from kind of additional supervision, where I do ask my client, you know, what is it like for you to have a therapist that is a woman? What is it like for you to have a therapist that is of a different ethnic background to you, or, you know, things of that sort? It's not common practice, and I think it can be really, I think it can put clients, it can make clients feel like they're kind of put on the spot. But I do prepare them for that. I always say, you know, we're going to process our similarities and our differences in the next session. You know, let's think about that. Because there are things about our identity that will always impact the therapeutic process. So for me, I always hear from a lot of clients, oh, it's really nice to have someone, especially from young people, you know, it's nice to have someone that's closer to me in age because I feel like you might understand me more. Or, you know, I've heard sometimes from clients that it's nice that you're from a different background because at least you can see what this, you know, what this might look like from the outside rather than from in it, where, you know, some things can feel quite normalized when you're within the culture, but when you're outside of it, you can see, you know, what just might feel a bit off.
I really like that, actually, because I think that, like you just said there, that things can almost become normalized, and so if there is something about that relationship that you develop with your therapist that is making you hold something back, it could just kind of become, you know, you don't really realize it anymore. So to have that space to reflect and to think, is the fact that, you know, our gender is the same, or our gender is different, or that our faith is different, or whatever, are any of these factors making you hold back things? Because it definitely could. And I think often, you know, maybe the idea in your head of somebody that's the, like, you know, the ideal therapist for you when you're actually working with them could be off. And I remember I started with a therapist a while back, and you know, where something just doesn't feel right, and then I was like, I'm not being completely honest here, and I just, rather than saying, oh, you know, it's my problem, it was like, no, sometimes the therapeutic relationship isn't right, and it's really important to have that reflection, for sure.
Absolutely. I had one of my supervisors say once, and I thought it was really inappropriate at the time, but now I can laugh it off. And she said, finding a therapist is like dating. You have to find the right fit.
Yeah.
And I think it makes a lot of sense. You know, at the end of the day, it is a relationship, not similar to dating, but it is a relationship. And yeah, you know, it takes kind of that click to feel like you can actually be vulnerable with that person. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you. Uh-huh. And thank you so much for the insights that you've given us. It's been a really interesting conversation. Where can people go to find out more about you?
You can find me on Instagram. That's the main platform that I'm on. It's at Therapy with Manal. And, you know, my email's there. Other ways to reach me are all there. But it's honestly been such a great conversation. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I always find that, you know, I think the more we speak about things like this, it helps, you know, it helps me reflect as well on, you know, mm-hmm. what it is that kind of works within the therapy room, what doesn't. And just things that I would want to, you know, do more of. But that's amazing. Thank you so much. Yeah.
No, it's actually been such a pleasure. And I think for me, it's so nice because it's not something that I have experience of. And so it really broadens my kind of thought about eating disorders and how they can develop and what can be supportive for people. So, yeah, it's been really lovely to chat to you. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah. Cool.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.